Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we are talking about something that sounds a bit nerdy, energy abundance and the solar transition. But before you immediately click on to your next podcast, Dad, give us the pitch about why people who aren't interested in the green revolution and industrial technology should hold on for a minute or two.
Yeah, I totally understand that for many people, you know, talking about solar energy for half an hour, you've got to be joking. I mean, you know, surely there's something more interesting to talk about.
Can we go back to ethics, abortion, euthanasia, embryos, something more tangible, please?
But I am completely convinced that there is an extraordinary revolution taking place here, which is going to change everybody's futures. And in many ways, it's an astonishingly good news story.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it saddens me that so often people's heads are filled with all the gloom and doom, you know, not only the gloom and doom of politics and shortage of money and, you know, an elderly graying population and all the rest.
But war also in Ukraine and Gaza.
But also climate change. You know, we're doomed. We're destroying the planet. There is no hope. We're all, you know, and all of those things are partly true. But there is, I think, here an astonishing good news story. And you know, and I think it's important for everybody to be aware of this is happening. And I think it's particularly important for Christians, because I think Christians can very easily get into the doom and gloom cycle and not see the other side. So, that's the pitch.
And to flag up that this is not simply a kind of dry technical conversation about the green transition and solar technology, but actually it digs into some really significant theological themes, which we'll get to in the second half, about what do Christians think about abundance and, you know, building heaven on earth and a future, you know, visions of kind of a future paradise. You know, is this about Jesus's call about life in all its fullness, or are we kind of being a bit idolatrous and getting ahead of ourselves? So I think there's some really interesting, specifically Christian responses to this kind of coming, the cusp of what we're on the cusp of, that we're going to try and, you know, cast out a few lines and see what we can hook onto in the second half of this.
Yeah, and so, you know, where we're going is the wonderful words in Isaiah, which, you know, ever since I first read them, I remember as a young man, you know, have always haunted me, really, by these wonderful words, Isaiah 35, the desert and the parched land will be glad, the wilderness will rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It will burst into bloom. It will rejoice greatly and shout for joy. And then a bit lower down, then will the eyes of the blind be open, the ears of the deaf unstopped, the lame leap like a deer, and the mute tongue shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness, streams in the desert. The burning sand will become a pool, the thirsty ground bubbling springs. And so there has always been this vision of abundance, of the transformation of God's good creation, and how you interpret those words. Traditionally, those words have always been interpreted, haven't they, as something for the new heaven and the new earth. These are pointing away from our sad, doomed planet. And are pointing away, but I am just interested to explore the possibility that they actually might be prophetic words which are relevant to this planet.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. That's all to come. But to start off with, let's explain what there is to be excited about, in particular when it comes to solar energy. People will be familiar with the basic idea. A lot of people might, you know, have seen them on people's roofs, people's houses. You know, you put up a solar panel, it soaks up the sun rays, it turns into electricity, and you can use electricity to do whatever you want. It's been around for decades. What is there to be so excited about? It seems like a relatively well-established technology now.
Yeah, so the first basic bit of physics is that the amount of energy that the sun dumps onto the planet is absolutely mind-bogglingly huge. I mean, it turns out to be approximately 1 kilowatt per square meter if you are on a bright sunny day near the equator. Now, obviously, you know, the further north, the clouds, everything else, there are lots of reasons why that is reduced. But if you just stop and think about what a kilowatt of energy.
What can you do with a kilowatt of energy?
Well, if you think what a 3 kilowatt fire is, a 3 kilowatt fire is a serious heating device, electrical device. A kilowatt of energy is a significant amount of energy. But when you think how many square meters there are across the planet, you know, you rapidly get into, you know, astronomical amounts of energy that are being poured on the planet. And at the moment, we are only using, you know, something like 0.01001% of all, most of it is completely wasted. It just heats up, you know, some of it is used for agriculture and some of it is used.
The trees enjoy a lot of it.
And so on. But nonetheless, vast amounts of, so particularly in Africa and in the Middle East, it's just a problem. Far, far too much energy pouring on the land. And of course, real concerns about global warming, about the greenhouse gases, means that this has generally been seen as a terrible problem. You know, this is something we should be, as much as possible, trying to avoid. Now, the idea that you could turn this sun into useful energy has been around for ages, but it's always been a bit of a toy, a bit of a minor. You know, we knew that you could have solar cells. I remember as a kid, you got these things and you put them in the sun and it made a needle flicker or something like that, you know, but it was just a kind of gimmick.
Yeah.
But what is happening is that we're in the midst of an extraordinary exponential phenomenon, and exponentials are very, very strange. So basically, what if you look back over the last 10, 15, 20 years, what you can see is the total amount of solar power that we are capable of generating on the planet has been doubling every 3 years. And that means once you get these graphs that just rise, that means every decade we go up 10 times. And as people look into the future, that suggests that by the mid-1930s, solar cells will be the biggest source of electrical power on the planet. The 2030s. And by the 2040s, if that doubling every 3 years continues, solar energy will have wiped out and overtaken every other source of energy on the planet. So how is that happening? I mean, that's one of the questions, isn't it? And it's a very curious thing, but it's basically a wonderful example of a virtuous circle that as the more you, not what normally happens, and oil is a classic example, is the more people burn oil for energy, the more the prices rise because the supply is limited and it's supply and demand. And, you know, everybody's worried about peak oil. What happens when the world runs out of oil and energy supply is that prices increase.
And it gets harder and harder to dig oil out of the ground because we're already exhausting the easy stuff close to the surface. And so the longer we keep on using oil, the more hard to reach and hard to drill and therefore more expensive the wells will be, et cetera.
Exactly right. But solar seems to be almost unique in that it operates in exactly the opposite way. And that is, the more that the demand for solar power grows, the cheaper it becomes. You can basically, because the manufacturing increases, it becomes more efficient. That means the cost of solar electricity falls. It's already true that solar electricity is becoming one of the cheapest sources of electricity compared with gas or oil or nuclear. And as the demand increases, as it gets cheaper, more people want it, so they make more solar cells, so it gets cheaper, so more people want it, and so you've got this virtuous circle. And you've also got virtually unlimited supply. Unlike oil, the sun is available across the planet and in virtually unlimited quantities.
And shines very reliably and very regularly for a predictable number of hours each day, and will continue doing so for at least another few hundred million years, at which point it won't be our problem to worry about what happens when the sun stops shining. So solar is getting cheaper, it's getting more abundant, there are more panels, and they're more efficient, and they cost less to buy and install every year. And there's no, we can foresee no exact reason why that should not continue into the future. So people are now starting to sketch out a world not too far away, maybe 10, 15, 20 years away, when actually you can basically carpet, every country will just carpet their land with solar panels, because they are both the cheapest and most obvious form of producing electricity, where you're not just replacing electricity that was previously generated by fossil fuels like coal and oil, but you're actually, you could start to produce more power than you did before under the old fossil fuel system.
Yeah, and carpet gives the wrong impression. You know, carpet sounds like the entire planet is going to be solar. But the truth is, all we need to move up from is 0.01% of the surface area of the energy up to, say, 1%. If we could take just literally 1% of all the sun's energy, we've got more than enough for foreseeable needs, almost. I mean, I've taken those things out of the air. But in other words, it's not a question of carpeting everywhere. It's just a question of just being efficient about where we putting solar cells. And interestingly, solar panels can be relatively unobtrusive compared to, you know, massive
wind turbines
and all the problems.
Nuclear power station.
Exactly. Solar panels can be relatively unobtrusive. And, you know, I've heard all kinds of bizarre ideas. I suspect they're not going to be necessary, but for instance, that you could put them all in the roads. You know, if you made every road a solar generator, you know, as they made a road, they embedded it with solar panels, you know, or you made every window. If every window of an office block or had embedded within it solar, which apparently you can do and make them transparent and still collect a proportion of the energy.
And as we improve battery storage technology and transmission, there's no real need for them to be close to where humans live necessarily either. And so, you know, we could take somewhere like, you know, large swathes of the Sahara Desert where literally no one lives, but it's very, very sunny, and build, you know, thousands upon thousands of square kilometers there, and then just lay power cables across the world and pipe the energy elsewhere. You could make floating arrays out at sea, again, where they're not causing anyone any concerns, and pipe it in. So you can see how people start to get excited about a world in which solar power, cheap, plentiful, zero carbon solar power, is the cornerstone of our kind of energy system. And it is creating what people often talk about as energy abundance. So not just replacing energy that we currently get from coal and gas, but saying, why don't we think about having 5, 10, 100 times more energy generation than we do right now? It's not a pipe dream. It is theoretically quite feasible.
Well, it seems to be. I mean, again, this all sounds like science fiction, and it, you know, I have strong echoes of novels, reading science fiction short stories and novels, you know, when I was younger, which you know, forecast what it would be like to live in a world of energy abundance. But yes, I mean, and the interesting thing is that, you know, solar power is projected in the relatively near future, within a few years, to be at least half the cost of any other source of electricity. And then, you know, the market will say, well, why on earth are we burning coal? Why are we burning oil? Why would you do it when you can get something for half the price? And so you then get this kind of transition all of a sudden when it's so much cheaper than everything else and it's clean and it's available. Why are we not building this up? Why are we not? And one of the fascinating things that, you know, this is where human ingenuity comes in. So apparently people are already working on the fact that, you know, in the States, there are areas, you know, the Nevada desert where you can, you've got vast amounts of sun, but where we need the energy is all up in, you know, the industrial centers and New York and so on. And the cost of putting cables across America for massive energy transfer is very significant. And then people have said, but hang on a minute, we can take one of those massive goods trains which trundle across America, and if we fill it with batteries, it goes to the Nevada desert, it charges up all its batteries, and then it trundles its way to New York, when it effectively becomes a power station in New York. And then when it's depleted, it trundles its way back to Nevada and so on. And so much, much cheaper than putting in power lines.
And if the train itself is running on electricity as well, it's got no carbon footprint. Yeah. I guess that's the kind of the dream. You know, I mean, there are other aspects we haven't covered. The fact that, unlike all other kind of previous forms of energy generation, solar happens everywhere on the earth, basically the same amount. So no one kind of particular region or geography can kind of strangle off supply, like you've seen with oil in particular, but in other things as well. And so it could even have kind of geopolitical consequences. You know, people, historians often say one of the major reasons why Britain became a leader in the Industrial Revolution was because it happens to sit on top of a very rich seam of coal, which it was dug out of the ground and powered the kind of steam age, which made Britain rich and powerful for a couple of hundred years. But there's no reason why other parts of the world, you mentioned Africa, the Middle East, places that get lots and lots of sun around the equator, previously kind of poor, underdeveloped regions perhaps, might become energy superpowers in the future, in the next century. And you might see a kind of interesting reversal of that, and maybe a second industrial revolution powered by solar energy, in which, you know, Saharan Africa is suddenly the locus and the center of. But a lot of people will say this is sounding a bit too good to be true. This is your classic pie in the sky. This is techno-optimism. We've talked about that on the podcast before. Can you understand why some people might just be intrinsically a little bit cynical about that? This kind of future world of energy abundance is just around the corner.
No, I can. I mean, it sounds completely, yeah, there has to be a very serious catch. This is all but, you know, and now here. But just to continue, just before we get to the bat, you know, to the problems, there is even, because this is where human ingenuity comes in, because once we have, even if it isn't free or very, very low cost, even if it is just very cheap, what could we do with an unlimited quantity of energy? And the thing is, once you have energy like that, there's almost no limit to what else you can do. So the first thing you can do is you can take seawater and desalinate it. And suddenly, you know, the water shortage, which seemed to be of such extraordinary severity, and people have predicted there are going to be future wars about water, about rivers and so on. But hang on a minute, how much water is in the seas? You know, and would it be possible to generate, to desalinate water? Another thing is energy, you know, that you can use solar power to then for agriculture. So you could imagine massively increasing agricultural yields by irradiating crops at night and by increasing the sunlight or whatever. And then there is even, you can remove carbon dioxide, you know. So, yeah, we've got a huge problem. But if we've got vast amounts of energy, there are lots of ways of using that energy to remove carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So I think that is where it does sound like science fiction. And the question could, well, okay, but we know that the world is fallen. We know that human beings are selfish. We know that there is. So how could this all go horribly wrong?
Listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
A lot of, you know, this is not the first time mankind has kind of predicted it's on the cusp of a world of endless abundance. You know, we had talk in the kind of early 20th century about, you know, that automation and machines would replace human labor and people would end up working, you know, only 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a week. And that clearly hasn't happened. In fact, the average amount of hours a Western person works has actually increased in my lifetime on average. And even more recently, after the invention of nuclear energy in the 1940s and 50s post-war, there was excitement about the idea that there was a dawning kind of nuclear age of energy abundance. And famously, a leading kind of American figure in the nuclear industry said that it quite soon electricity would be too cheap to meter. You know, where it's so the unit cost is so low, you don't even bother to measure. You just let people use as much as they want and you just charge them a kind of flat rate, you know, kind of what we used to do with water and that kind of thing. That clearly hasn't happened. People still have to pay still meter their energy and pay per unit. So you can understand if a cynic might say, you know, human beings often get captured by exciting kind of techno utopian fantasies, but the world has a depressing likelihood of finding fresh limitations and fresh hurdles that we hadn't envisaged that mean that this kind of runaway virtuous cycle almost never, the flywheel effect almost never catapults us up into some kind of luxurious bliss.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think it's very understandable why, you know, we've heard all this before, you know, yawn, yawn, this is going to be another, you know, bubble that bursts and we're going to discover there's some terrible problem here. I mean, one obvious short-term threat is that China completely dominates solar cell production. And there's been massive investment from the Chinese government into factories producing solar. And if, you know, due to geopolitical events, China was suddenly to turn off the tap and say no more solar panels for the world, that would cause a huge solar shock temporarily.
But I guess the huge advantage, and we've seen that before, right? We saw that with OPEC, the cartel of oil producing companies have several times over the 20th century kind of turned off the taps or reduced supply for geopolitical reasons, which caused huge crisis in the rest of the world that relies on that oil. And I guess that's a concern for sure, but I guess the retort would be a massive difference is that unlike oil, everywhere receives sunshine, whereas oil is only available in certain very specific places on Earth, and the countries that sit above those deposits guard them jealously, whereas China could turn off the taps and there would be a delay while the rest of the world caught up and learned how to make such efficient and cheap solar panels. But there's little reason to suspect that we wouldn't be able to catch up eventually, and once we did and we produced solar panels locally and installed them locally, we genuinely are truly energy independent for the first time.
Yeah, and that's already happening. I mean, there is a massive now investment in many countries because people are all waking up to the potential here. Interestingly, part of there is a problem here, and that is if it becomes so cheap you can't make any profits, you know, all of a sudden your business model starts to look shaky because, you know, everyone's doing the same and it's just getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. So there are issues, but it's hard to see those as being deal breakers. Another point that's often brought up is about all the chemicals that are required to make the solar panels and the damage that is being done, and the rare chemicals and so on. And I mean, that is obviously an issue. But again, I think it's generally thought that there's nothing particularly. I mean, solar panels are made out of silicon, which is basically sand. You know, and therefore, you know, there doesn't seem to be much shortage of the raw materials, and that yes, there may be some rare chemicals that are required, but that none of this is likely to become a serious limitation. So,
I wonder if a more likely kind of choke point would actually be around the battery technology, which is really fundamentally a chemistry problem rather than a kind of industrial economic problem. And, you know, there's enormous research going in, and there's some interesting new forms of battery technology which have been pioneered, also coming out of China in many ways, thanks to very canny but enormous state subsidies and investment by the Chinese government trying to make itself an indispensable battery superpower. So maybe we will have a breakthrough and find ways of building batteries that are both better and for storage, but also don't require on these kind of limited rare earth metals that we currently use. But that might be another possible kind of hurdle to overcome.
Yes. But this again is the extraordinary thing about the capitalist, the way the market works, because exactly the same virtuous circle seems to be taking place in batteries now. So the more that there is a recognition, there's a desperate demand for batteries, that means that everywhere people are trying to meet that demand, and the more they meet that demand, the cheaper production costs, and then there's more demand for batteries. And so again, you know, once there doesn't seem to be any fundamental reason why batteries are not going to get cheaper and cheaper and more efficient. And the more scientists that are working on research, they're using AI now to investigate new chemicals and so on. It would be very surprising if that turned out to be a massive roadblock. It doesn't seem to be. So I think from that point of view, again, it's hard to see the roadblocks. To be honest, I think one of the interesting things is about human psychology, because there are already areas, aren't there, Tim, where we do have abundance, where we have things which are too cheap to meter, and yet we don't feel it. We don't, as human beings, we don't feel, gosh, isn't this amazing, what abundance we have. The first time I really noticed that was during the pandemic, when, you know, there was this enormous threat to humanity, and we're all stuck in that, we're locked down in our homes, and we all turned to the internet, and I, you know, we started doing this podcast. I remember having being involved in webinars and Zoom calls and online calls across the world, and discovering you could sit in your backside and you could literally spend hours having full video online calls with people around the world, and apparently it didn't cost anything.
Yeah. Which, if you had said to someone even 20 or 30 years ago, would have seen a kind of very distant kind of Star Trek-y dream, the idea that you could, you know, pull a small handheld device out of your pocket and have a live full color video chat with that person, with someone else in another part of the world on their own handheld device, and it could last for hours and no one cared how long it went on for. There would be no bill arriving in the post at the end of it. It wouldn't drain your battery ridiculously. This is just kind of an everyday occurrence.
Absolutely. I mean, my memory of international phone calls, which I do remember, you know, it was like you planned for it. Okay, we're going to do this, you know, synchronize, we're going to do this, you know, at this moment, are you ready? And then, you know, once you got through, first it was like talking through a hurricane, you know, but what you could sense was the meters going, you know, sorry, we've got to go now. I just say that we'll put it down, you know, because every minute was costing, you know,
every second, yeah,
you know, several pounds a minute. You could just sense the meters whirring. And that was just normal. That's, of course, we're talking across the world. Yeah. And yet suddenly it's free. It doesn't cost at all. Yeah. It's too cheap to meter.
And that is, as you say, a great example of something that has become too cheap to meter very rapidly. You know, when I got my first smartphone kind of contract, it was, you know, something like 100 minutes of calls, 100 texts and 100 megabytes downloaded on the internet. And that would cost you whatever it would cost you a month. And then gradually it expanded. But for about, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years, basically everyone I know has been on an unlimited plan in which, you know, you just pay a flat amount per month to your provider and you get as much internet as you want. There isn't a number of gigabytes that you can download on your computer before you have to wait for the month to reset. It is genuinely so cheap for the internet providers to provide us this data and access to the internet that they don't bother to count it anymore. They just say, just pay for the right to have the access and you can use as much of it as you want. And that is something that's come from, that's been very scarce and expensive to too cheap to meter in what, a decade or two?
Yeah. And another example is, you know, navigation. So now let's just get me right. You're planning to navigate someone and you're planning to take some sophisticated radio telephony signals and then use satellite tracking. You're going to use these satellites and you're going to use that to determine your position. Then you're going to use an AI to calculate the optimal trajectory to good luck with that. And how much does that cost for every minute of satellite usage? Well, it's free, isn't it? I mean, these satellites, they all just run for free, you know, all the technology that keeps them there in space, that maneuvers them, the power that beams back down to Earth, that's all free, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, if you go back through human history, ever since we, you know, first started moving beyond our own villages, we have struggled and wrestled with the problem of how to navigate around the Earth's surface. And, you know, I remember, you know, the Royal Navy had this huge issue that couldn't calculate longitude reliably. And they set up like a massive, in today's money, like multi-million pound government prize for the first person to crack the problem of how to, because they couldn't, you know, dominate the world and take over if they couldn't figure out where a ship was in the middle of the ocean. And then, you know, in the 70s and 80s, we invent GPS and now the navigation problem is just solved, because with a incredibly cheap piece of technology that you can install on anything, you can know where you are within a few meters anywhere in the world, any time of day, forever.
Yeah, there is a twist to the story here, because the navigation system is much more fragile than most people realize. And I don't know whether this is an apocryphal story or not, but I had it on good authority that all sailors, you know, US sailors, Royal Navy sailors and so on, in the West, were all trained on navigation using the stars as a backup system if everything else failed, you know, and you are alone in the Atlantic and this is how you find out where you are. And then along comes GPS and people say, oh, there's no point, you know, you've got GPS. But guess what? I understand that navies are training again on how to find their navigation using the stars. And that is what happens if the other side destroy all the navigation satellites. How are we going to find out where we are? So, I mean, planes would suddenly find again they were in deep trouble. And you know, the consequences if GPS suddenly got switched off would be amazing. But in other words, technology is much more fragile than is always reckoned.
It's certainly true. But I guess the fundamental point, as you were making, is that there are some other examples where technology has created genuine abundance. And the overwhelming human response is a kind of shrug. And we just integrate this into our expectations in the baseline raises, and we don't kind of marvel at the wonder of this and relish our power. We just say, yeah, well, good, I should be able to know where I am at all times anywhere, and I should be able to video call anyone in the planet at any time for free. And I suspect if we do, you know, use this solar revolution to increase our energy production tenfold or a hundredfold, people will very quickly find ways of using all that energy, and then people won't feel quite so energy abundant as we would like to expect.
Well, and it may be, and this says more about us as fallen human beings, doesn't it, than that we lose our sense of what an extraordinary time we're already living in, and what technology for all its disadvantages is providing for us. But yeah, it's I think, of course, nobody can see the future, and it could be that all of these projections suddenly run into the sand. Certainly, you know, if tragically there was a major international conflict, and we've already seen with Russia and the Middle East that actually serious conflicts can come rapidly. You know, if there was a major geopolitical conflict, you could imagine that all of this, that virtuous circle suddenly got on hold. It doesn't mean it would be lost, but I think it could be dramatically delayed. But nonetheless, if we just step back and say, okay, so if the direction of travel seems to be that energy is going to get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, we are moving to at least a relative abundance of energy on the planet. And the other thing we seem to be moving to is the relative abundance of digital machine intelligence. The cost of computing power in all its different forms is, again, tending towards zero. And so then the question is, well, why is this happening? If we step back and ask, what is there a wider significance to these extraordinary changes, which are genuinely haven't happened before in the history of humankind?
And this is where I guess some people do return to passages in scripture like Isaiah 35. The desert and the parched land will be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus, it will burst into bloom. The eyes of the blind be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped. Water will gush forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The burning sand will become a pool and thirsty grounds, bubbling springs. There's this rich theme, as we talked about at the beginning, in Christian tradition of a kind of future hope where barrenness is turned into kind of fecundity, to use a strange word. You know, there's what was previously a desert becomes a garden. What was parched becomes kind of flowing with water. And some people would say, you know, turning the Sahara into a 22nd century energy generating superpower is a version of that. Do you buy into that idea that we can that this future abundance that our technology and our ingenuity might be leading us towards is in somehow also a kind of spiritual calling about renewing and making the earth even better?
Well, I mean, just to step back a little bit, you know, I think we've talked in previous podcasts about this. One of the fundamental understandings of creation theology is the extraordinary generosity of God, that God gives his gifts with overwhelming generosity. He always, and it's a theme, isn't it, throughout the whole scripture, that whenever God gives, he doesn't give in a kind of, well, I suppose you can have a bit of that, but don't use it too much. It's this sense of the Father's heart is to give generously, and that creation, you know, you go back to the Garden of Eden before the fall, where God says, you can eat of anything you want. You know, here's this wonderful garden and you can eat the fruit of any tree. It's entirely up to you. There's this sense of fecundity, as you use your word, of extraordinary
bounteousness,
bounteous, yeah. goodness, the goodness of creation. It's
And Jesus picks up on that, doesn't he? You know, people famously come to that passage in Luke 6 about a good measure pressed down, shaken together and running over will be poured into your lap. You know, or I have come that you might have life, and life in all its fullness, in its abundance, as some translations have. So this idea that Jesus picks up on this Old Testament theme and says, you know, my coming is a realization of this promise of God's lavishness, his extravagance.
And so when we think about the planet Earth through those kind of spectacles, what we see is not this parsimonious, you know,
pinched,
which, to be honest, has often been a theme, hasn't it, of the kind of ecological movement. you know, that the carrying capacity of the planet. There's just too many mouths. There's too much, you know, they're making too much mess. They're destroying the planet. We need to shrink down. We need to reduce expectations. We need all to learn to live parsimoniously. That seems to me in conflict with this theme of abundance. And when you look at the raw resources which God is pouring, and this is where, you know, the solar energy, you think how much God says, okay, you might need energy. You know what? I'm going to give you so much energy.
Yeah.
You're not going to know what to do with it. Oh, you might need water. Well, okay, I'm going to give you so much water. And so on. So the fundamental theological question behind this is, on the one hand, there's a sort of Gnosticism, an incipient Gnosticism, which the Christian faith has always been infected by, right the back to those very first centuries. You know, this ancient heresy that says God is just not interested in the material world, that all that matters is this spiritual spark. You know, we're in this dungeon of dark evil, and let's just focus on that spiritual spark, and let's look to the future when God is going to take that spiritual spark. Death is a liberation. At last, we're away from this terrible sinking cesspit of the body and of the fallen creation, and at last we get back to God. Versus this idea of what is often called realized eschatology, that God's promises are not just about a future hope beyond death, but actually God, that many of God's promises are intended for this time, for this planet, for this age. And that the ways that God brings out about his purposes are often very curious. They're not, you know, time and time again in the history of the faith, it seems that very unexpected, unpredictable things have happened. I mean, who would have thought the invention of the printing press might have any significance in the spread of the Christian faith?
Yeah, that was the example that was literally going through my head as you started saying that. Yeah, exactly the same thing I thought of. I mean, in many ways, it strikes me that those two sides of the coin, or those two kind of competing traditions, you can almost map them onto the green movement, you know, because you have a part of the green movement, as you say, which is about, which has a kind of an ascetic streak to it, about live lightly on the earth, let's reduce maybe fears about overpopulation and carrying capacity and, you know, neo-Malthusianism. Reduce, reuse, recycle, let's make everything, let's do less, let's consume less. People are going to have to make sacrifices, tighten their belts. We've become greedy and fat and decadent. We consume too much. And then there's the other side, which says, no, let's go bigger the other way. Let's, you know, build vast arrays of offshore wind and solar panels everywhere and nuclear power stations in every town. And let's use all of our power not to shrink and to become kind of hermits, but actually just to better reuse the raw stuff of creation in a less destructive way. And you could almost map those onto the Christian traditions of, you know, let's not worry too much about what's going on here and now, but let's be focused on a kind of future spiritual world, versus the strands of theology which get very focused on how can we build heaven on earth, you know, how can we see the kingdom coming now. And sometimes that's called an over-realized eschatology, you know, where certain Christian traditions have sometimes got a little bit too excited about building the new heaven on earth, and they get so focused on, you know, one version of it might be the kind of the social gospel of the 20th century, where we get so focused on kind of improving people's social conditions here that we forget about that we're also focused on saving their souls. But you also might have, you know, versions of Pentecostalism and charismatic Christianity, which get so obsessed with about doing works of power in the spirit here and now, and about, you know, why aren't we seeing more healing and resurrections, yeah, and prosperity. All these, the prosperity gospel, it is often a form of over-realized eschatology that, you know, not holding the now and the not yet in its right tension.
Yeah, absolutely right. And these are complex issues, but you know, God is working his purposes out. And as I say, it, often these things happen in a very unexpected way. And I think it is fascinating to me that, you know, so much of the modern capitalist system is dominated by greed and by acquisitiveness and human, you know, a very fallen instinct sometimes. And yet, you know, might it be that God in his sovereign purposes can take, you know, I think of that phrase, even the wrath of man shall praise me, you know, that in his sovereign and providential purposes, God can use even fallen capitalist acquisitive greed to actually lead to an astonishing pro-human abundant future for his people. And yes, I mean, neither of us will want to say this is the sum total of the good news. It isn't, you know, the good news has to be one about us, as including the spiritual significance of reconciliation with God. And however much the deserts are blooming, if our hearts are not redeemed and renewed and turned towards God himself, then this is not the good news. But is it possible that the good news includes solar abundance, technological abundance, and the transformation of the world in ways we hadn't anticipated?
I mean, people would point, as another example of that, the extraordinary advances we've seen in the, thanks to kind of Western industrialized capitalism, in poverty reduction. You know, hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people lifted out of poverty over the last 50, 60, 70 years. You know, and almost entirely not because of great charitable work or excellent redistribution, but because capitalism got stuck in places in Asia, Africa, countries like China, and it's remarkably effective at generating wealth, creating economies of scale, and creating jobs, and that ultimately, you know, has a virtuous cycle of pulling people out of poverty. You know, no one says that you know, capitalism is integral to Christianity, and yet clearly modern capitalism has managed to achieve ends which we can quite happily say God is in favor of.
Yes, and I think the medical advances, if you look at infant mortality across the world, the transformation for both infants and child death and disease is absolutely astonishing. I mean, you know, for thousands of years there have been extraordinary levels of child and infant mortality and child disease, and it's literally in the last few decades that across the world these have plummeted in a way that we have never seen before. And and that is a mix of things, of improved hygiene, basic public health, plus medical interventions, you know, vaccines and basic medical care for children around the world. So extraordinary things are happening, wonderful things. And it saddens me, you know, to come back to perhaps the beginning, that so many God's people are living in the pit of total despair and a sense of futility about the current world.
I guess I have a niggling doubt at the back of my mind as you have this conversation, that are we all getting carried away? And even if all these, you know, these possible futures come to pass, is it not a form of idolatry? Are we ultimately kind of worshipping our own ingenuity and our cleverness and saying, isn't it wonderful? We've made the desert bloom. But if you go back to that passage, it's not really about the desert blooming. It's a metaphor, because you know, if you read on, the glory of Lebanon will be given to it, the splendor of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the splendor of our God, not the glory of Israel. And then it goes on to say, you know, say to those with fearful hearts, be strong, do not fear. Your God will come. He will come with vengeance, with divine retribution. He will come to save you. So ultimately, the blooming of the desert is not a metaphor for about building heaven on earth, but it's about the joy and that we should be pointing to God, to the second coming, to God intervening in his people Israel, you know, as we saw hundreds of years after this passage was written in the person of Jesus. And I would worry if Christians got so carried away with excitement about, you know, energy abundance and a second industrial revolution and this, all the amazing things we could do with our solar power, that we lost sight that really all of this good stuff that we're able to pull out of God's creation should be pointing us back to saying to people, you know, what Isaiah is saying, you know, be strong, do not fear, your God will come. He will come to save you.
Yeah. And of course, I hear that. And of course, that is the traditional, you know, I can hear people thinking, but this passage has absolutely nothing to say about solar. And, you know, this is symbolism about God's work in the heart and ultimately, you know, is about the new heaven and the new earth. Is absolutely zero, you know, traditional biblical interpretation would say this has zero to say about anything that happens in Africa and the Sahara. But that's what I want to question. I mean, I want to question that traditional interpretation, because if you take that traditional interpretation, you then have to say, and everything that we happen to see and all these exponentials and these astonishing things, utterly irrelevant, you know, no significance. That's what I find hard to accept. I find hard to accept that something quite so extraordinary and unexpected, and the normally fairly sane, you know, the reason we're talking about this, what stimulated it was The Economist magazine, which has devoted a significant part to it, to precisely these kind of speculations. You know, it's not normally a magazine which is prone to ridiculous flights of fancy.
Yeah, it's quite sober, isn't it?
You know, and a lot of investors and serious businessmen read it. So what I would like to say is, you know, should we be at least watching this as Christian believers, instead of just saying, oh, it's utterly irrelevant, let's just concentrate on carrying our traditional religious activities and let the heathen do whatever the heathen are going to do? Or should we be saying, is it possible that God's strategies and plans for this planet are rather different from us? And of course, you know, who created the sun? You know, where did all this solar power coming from? You know, can human beings say, you know, it's all us and our ingenuity. Aren't we clever? You know, hang on a minute. And who gave human beings the ingenuity and to create solar cells and the scientific knowledge to work it all out? And, you know, it's...
And that's where I'd want to end or underline is that, you know, I'm on board with the excitement. You know, I'm all in for a future world of energy abundance, and I'm excited. But I don't want this to become, you know, another golden calf where we get so carried away, or a Tower of Babel, if there's a better biblical metaphor. We get so carried away with how amazing we are that, as you say, it becomes a form of idolatry, and we forget that actually we didn't set the sun hundreds of millions of miles away, this burning ball of gas, constant rolling nuclear fusion explosions. You know, we had nothing to do with that. We are simply the grateful recipients of God's bounty and God's extravagance and God's abundance. And if we're able to harness 1% of that, that should prompt us to fall on our knees on our newly non-parched desert sand and praise him for it, right? Rather than getting lost in raptures about what an amazing world we've built for ourselves.
No, absolutely right. And but I just don't see that as the overriding risk of Christians in the 21st century. I see the reverse. I see this incipient Gnosticism as being a very, very strong theme at least in many of the circles in which I move, and just a lack of interest in what's happening elsewhere, because it's clearly irrelevant to God's purposes. And that's what I want to question and say, you know, might we have got it wrong? Do we need to go back and rethink? And at least, is it possible that God's plans for this planet are rather different from the way that the Christian narrative is so often presented?
Well, lots to think about there. It's probably time to draw it to a close. We're closing in an hour. Didn't think we had it an hour and so many panels in us, Dad, but you never know. I hope we've carried the listeners with us. Thanks for listening and taking part in this conversation. We'd love to hear your own thoughts on energy abundance, the solar transition, Isaiah 35, and much more. So do get in touch with us if you've got any questions, any comments, disagreements, feedback, suggestions of future things we could talk about in MOLAD. You can email MOLAD, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. But otherwise, we'll be back with another episode next week. And until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.